This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When you think about prisoners and the environment, and even when you hear of these issues and the ways in which prisoners are being affected by the prison environment, there's a part of people that thinks they just shouldn't have gotten locked up if they didn't want to face these issues. So there's a high barrier to getting people to really care and want to do something about this issue.
Plastic and prisons, two of America's most toxic habits. Happily, there are people working to create alternatives. This week on Sea Change Radio, we learn about a new type of flexible, compostable packaging developed by Israeli entrepreneur Daphna Nissenbaum, who hopes this new polymer will take a bite out of the enormous problem of plastic waste. Next, we speak to Zoe Loftus-Farron about her Earth Island Journal piece that exposes the multitude of environmental hazards created by the prison industrial complex and America's unhealthy addiction to locking people up. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daphna Nissenbaum. She is the founder of TIPA. Daphna, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Coming to us from just north of Tel Aviv, Israel, right?
Right, that's where I am, yeah.
So why don't you tell us about your invention, TIPA? It's very intriguing, and maybe give us a little bit about your background and the journey that you took to get to where you are right now as the founder and CEO of this company and its product, compostable plastic called TIPA.
Sure. So in TIPA, what we do is we invented the technology of fully compostable plastic for food packaging or for packaging in general. Actually, the idea was born from a need. And the trigger was an argument that I had with one of my kids about what he does or what they do with their plastic bottles or plastic packaging. And I was saying that we have to reuse or recycle, etc., etc. And when I thought about it and I figured out that there are so many discussions and arguments like that, I thought that there must be a different way to treat plastic waste. I tried to figure out to myself what is the best and natural way that I discard waste. And immediately I thought about an apple or an orange, for example. So if I eat an apple and I throw the apple residuals to the waste bin, I feel fine with that. I mean, this is a very natural thing to do, and the apple just disintegrates. And so I thought to myself, why won't we create a package that is like nature creation? It's like organic waste. It just decomposes and turns into something else in a very natural way. And that's how the idea was born. I'm not coming from this world of packaging or of chemist, but and that's why I'm saying the idea was born from a real need. And then we developed the technology.
And you're originally a software engineer, correct?
Right, I am. I was actually educated in one of the elite units in the Israeli army. And what we learned there is to think out of the box and to come up with innovation. And that's part of what I did here.
Give us an idea of why plastic has become such a burden for our planet. And maybe a quick overview for our listeners who aren't up to date on the billions of plastic waste and how your company plans to make a difference.
So, a recent study just showed that we've been using more than 1.1 billion tons of plastic since 1950. Of that amount, nearly 7 billion tons are no longer used, and only 9% has been recycled. Okay, that's one study. The other study shows, and that was just published recently, that plastic parts, they found plastic parts in the water that we drink. Okay, so you have, in one hand, a research that shows the huge amounts of plastic that we use, and where it goes doing that way in different ways in the world, even to our water. So this is a general plastic study. When we talk about packaging has the majority of plastic waste. And if we look, for example, at the food industry, 66% from the plastic packaging waste comes from the food industry. It's a huge amount. And this is an industry that grows almost 5% per year. So 66% goes to, in terms of volume, comes from the food industry. Now, if we look at the food industry, part of it can be recycled. Part of those packages can be recycled. What? Bottles can be recycled because they are made out of from one material. But if we look at all the rest, okay, at the flexible packaging, just think about granola bars or potato chips bags or fresh produce or bread or cheese or meat. All those packages that are kind of soft packages that are made from films, those packages cannot be recycled, or the majority cannot be recycled. The studies show today that 95% of all flexible packaging is not recycled, from few reasons. The main reason is that those packages actually use few materials within the same package. Anyway, what I'm saying is that 95% from all this huge amount of packages actually ends life either in landfills or in the sea or in the fields or whatever. And the studies also show that conventional plastic will stay here, either in landfill or someplace else, for hundreds of years. So it might be 400 or 500 or 600 years. It doesn't really matter. It's hundreds of years. And this is where TIPA starts to act to our innovation. What we're saying is we are going to focus on the end of life of the package. That after we use the package and we eat the content of the package or drink the content of the package will go together with the organic waste stream and will decompose the same way as our organic waste and become a compost, which is a fertilizer that can be used as a resource. And this is, by the way, this is what the industry calls natural recycling. So we take packages, we turn it into fertilizer. That's recycling. But that means that instead of having plastic piling all over the world, we can have plastic turning into a resource in the right and natural way.
Now let's get to the nuts and bolts of the product. How does TIPA differ from existing compostable plastic solutions that we might see on the market right now here in the U.S.?
What we do is we developed technology that is similar to conventional plastic in one hand, that brings the same property as the plastic that is used today for packaging, but it's compostable. So whatever you can see today in the market are plastic packages that are not compostable and cannot be recycled. That's the flexible packaging. And what we invented are plastic or materials that actually behave or bring the same properties as conventional plastic in terms of food protection, or how we use the packages, etc., etc. But it decomposes like organic waste post-consumption.
So you have, for example, in the U.S. market, there are ones that are based on with cornstarch. What are your material sources here? And how does that carry out in terms of its usability?
We use different materials. What we do actually is we developed films. Films are the basic materials for packaging, for flexible packaging. So we developed films, and in each film, I may say that we have between 5 to 10 different materials or raw materials in each film. And together with the particular formulas that we have developed, you get a film that is actually transparent and have a similar strength and similar tear resistance and all the set of high-level or premium properties that are needed for packaging, for a package to be able to meet the same shelf life as needed, etc. So it's different from the materials that you are familiar with in the market. Usually, the compostable materials have been in the market in the last, I would say, between 15 to 20 years. But the majority of the applications that we can see today with compostable materials are either shopping bags or trash bags or mulch films. We can hardly see packages with long shelf life. And that's what we have invented.
So it's different than like a sandwich bag that is not watertight and needs to be composted by like an industrial waste management facility. Yours is able to be watertight and be composted in the backyard and decompose if you had a compost heap. Is that right?
Yeah, we have developed also, that's a good example. We have also developed sandwich bags, zipper bags, that can be used for example, for sandwiches, like the kids take to school, etc. We developed those bags which are fully transparent. The zipper is also fully compostable, and it's been sold by Reuse It in the U.S., and it's fully compostable, and it's not just industrial compostable, it's also home compostable, so you can just discard it in your home compost facility.
Now, I noticed that it was made of petroleum as well. Is that a problem in terms of the source materials, or is this still environmentally very sound? Maybe you can explain how petroleum is used in the process.
Yeah, definitely. That's kind of confusing. You're right. So we use materials, polymers, and materials that are fully compostable. The source of the material can be either bio-based or fossil derivative-based. Anyway, in those two cases, the polymers are compostable, which means that the polymers are chains of materials. The chains of materials break into small parts with certain humidity and heat, and then the small parts are eaten by bacteria, and that's how the compost is created. Okay, so all the materials, even if it's bio-based or non-bio-based, go through the same process of breaking down and then biodegradation.
You don't want to marry me, you just want to be my friend. You said you'd cook my breakfast, you'd bring it to the bed. If I feel kind of bad, you'd be there to rub my aching head. Yeah, I am. I'm wrapped up in love again.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daphna Nissenbaum. She's the CEO and co-founder of TIPA. So, Daphna, one of the problems with plastic waste and one of the reasons why it's just everywhere is it's just so damn cheap. How can your company compete with some of the large-scale plastic manufacturers? What kind of price point are you at now, and where do you need to be to ultimately replace the dirtier non-compostable plastics in the world?
Thank you for this question. It's a very good question. Of course, new technology costs more. Of course, innovation costs more. We all know that, not from only from packaging. Currently, we are more expensive. Why? Due to amounts. Due to very, very low scale in comparison to conventional plastic. Which means that it's unique technology. But unique technology, it costs a little more, but it's a huge opportunity. It's a huge opportunity to companies to come out with innovation that can really change the world. It's a new opportunity for consumers to demand a new innovation that can really change the world. So currently we are more expensive. And when we talk about a package, let's say about granola bar or whatever, or a potato chips bag, so it will cost a few cents more. Yes, it will cost currently a few cents more. But in the future, we'll meet, once economies of scale will meet larger scales, we can compete with a plastic pricing. It's evolution, it will take time, but we'll get there. And TIPA acts in a way, our company develops the technology and acts in a way of being mass market player.
So Daphna, maybe you can give us a snapshot of your company right now in terms of your funding, your headcount, and for listeners who want to learn more about it, your website and any other kind of information you can give.
Okay, so first of all, I encourage everyone to go to our website. And it's tipa-corp.com, tipa-corp.com. And see our technology and products that you can already find in the market. You don't have to do much in order to use our products. For example, you can just order the sandwich bags in the reuse it website, and you'll get it into your home, and you can start using compostable materials right away. You can always look for our products and purchase as well through the website and through other websites. The company was funded around 5 years ago. We developed the technology. We are backed by strong investors. Few funds. One of them is Canadian Israeli Fund. The other one is Horizons Ventures, which are belong to Lee Kashin. The second one is, and the third one now, we got investment from a new large family office from the U.S. So the company is based in Israel. We do have sales office in the U.S. in New Jersey. And the technology is already out there in several segments. And as I said, I encourage everyone to visit our website, and we will be able to provide more information. We'll be happy to provide more information as required.
Daphna Nissenbaum is the CEO and co-founder of TIPA. Daphna, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Zoe Loftus-Farron. She's the managing editor of Earth Island Journal. Zoe, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why don't you give us a little overview of a piece that you co-authored with Candace Byrne and Maureen Nandi Mitra called America's Toxic Prisons. What were you looking for when you decided to do this piece?
Yeah, so we really wanted to get into the intersection of mass incarceration and environmental issues and environmental justice in the United States specifically. So looking at the ways in which our system of incarceration is impacting the health of prisoners through the siting of prisons and the conditions within the prison, such as the water they're drinking, the air around them, that kind of stuff, as well as the impact of prisons themselves on nearby communities through similar means, pollution from the prison, water and sewage systems, their energy generation systems, that kind of thing.
And after reading the piece, it seems like there are probably so many of these egregious examples of environmental catastrophe on the brink, if you will. How did you pick and choose which ones to focus on as you did your research?
Yeah, you know, we started with kind of a broader look, and we also relied on the Human Rights Defense Center, their nonprofit out in Florida that's done quite a bit of research into this issue as well and has compiled some examples. So using like their basis and some of our own research, we kind of decided to focus in on three different regions since we had three reporters and looked at California, Texas, and Pennsylvania kind of as our case studies, if you will.
And most experts look at the explosion in prison population as kind of a indictment of the drug war from the 80s. And if you look at since the 70s, the U.S. has seen a 700% increase in the number of people imprisoned. So it's become quite a profitable business as well. Did you see any discrepancy in your research between the private prisons and the public prisons in terms of their environmental stewardship? or lack thereof.
Yeah, you know, that was an issue that we went into the research and reporting very interested in, and we weren't actually able to tease out a lot of the details around that. I don't know if you saw, we kind of had a side box on the difficulties of analyzing the data. And one of the issues, we requested records from the EPA as well as some state agencies on violations, environmental violations in prisons and jails. And the data we got back was really incomplete, and it was hard to kind of draw a lot of conclusions from it. But it's an ongoing series that we're reporting on, and that is one of the topics that we're hoping to kind of dig into a bit more.
So on the surface, one might think that there's not really a big environmental cost to putting people behind bars. Obviously, there's a social justice and just a humanitarian issue at hand. But just putting all things aside, one would think that a prisoner would have a much lower carbon footprint than a person who's not in prison. But it seems like that's offset by the lack of regulations when it comes to these physical plants of the prisons themselves. That seems to be the big issue. Is that fair to say?
By the footprint of the prisons themselves?
No, it seems like an average prisoner's carbon footprint may be much smaller than a non-prisoner in America, because they're not traveling, they're not driving around, they're not controlling their own thermostat, etc. But it seems like the environmental cost comes from the lack of regulation, from the physical plant itself, from the prison itself, and pollution and the effect that has on both the population in the prison and, as you found, in the immediate environs as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. There doesn't seem to be enough regulation of this area, perhaps just due to lack of resources and staff at the EPA and other state agencies, something that seems like it might get only worse under the current administration. And that definitely leads to, in a lot of the cases that we saw, a pretty big environmental footprint from certain prisons. And even more, the side that we were looking at was the impact on the prisoners themselves due to this lack of kind of oversight and enforcement of environmental rules in the prisons.
So let's dig into some of the details. Why don't we start with the California Men's Colony? This is not a private prison, but what seems to be the problem there in terms of its environmental issues?
Yeah, they have a really long history of water pollution issues. They're, you know, right in off the coast, the California coast in San Luis Obispo. And, you know, I think maybe for the past three decades, at least the last two decades, they've been had problems with dumping waste into local waterways. And they've received some pretty hefty fines for that, at least as far as, you know, the fines that we came across in our research. These were some of the highest ones. And they did also upgrade their, you know, water management system. But even so, the violations have continued until at least early this year. I'm not sure. I think the last one I saw was January of this year.
And you have a sidebar here as well that gives you kind of an overview of several of the hot spots in the country, from California to Texas, New York, Kentucky, Colorado. Did you find any kind of commonality? It seems like maybe they get built on pretty unhealthy ground to begin with, a lot of Superfund cleanup sites, and they don't exactly have the healthiest foundations to begin with.
Definitely, that's a trend that we saw. A lot of prisons and jails across the country are built on really marginal lands that are often repurposed following, you know, some kind of industrial use. They might be really on or near Superfund sites. I think our analysis showed that nearly 600 federal and state prisons are within 3 miles of a Superfund site, and more than 100 are within 1 mile. So, they're kind of repurposing this land for one of the only kind of, I guess, acceptable uses for such degraded places, and also often, you know, places that are more out of sight, more rural, not always, but often in more rural areas where we don't really see what's happening.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Zoe Loftus-Farron. She's the managing editor of Earth Island Journal. So Zoe, maybe you can give us some anecdotes, some of the people you spoke to in prison who've been affected by these environmentally shaky prisons.
Sure. I spoke with a few different prisoners in California, particularly those who have suffered from valley fever, which is a fungal infection that's endemic to the southwest United States, often, you know, found in arid areas. It's carried in the dust. Kenneth Hartman is one of the prisoners I spoke with. He's incarcerated at Lancaster and got valley fever in 2008, and really explains that, you know, how sick he was. He really realized at one point if he didn't get treatment and start to recover quickly, he thought he was going to die. And he really points out, and we have a quote of him in the piece to this extent, you know, that a lot of times people kind of, when you think about prisoners and the environment, and even when you hear of these issues and the ways in which prisoners are being affected by the prison environment, you kind of, there's a part of people that thinks they just shouldn't have gotten locked up if they didn't want to face these issues. So there's a high barrier to getting people to really care and want to do something about this issue.
You also speak to Todd Love in an Avenel State Prison in Central Valley, California. It seemed like one of the more common afflictions is valley fever. Now, can this be attributed specifically to environmental issues, or is that just something that happens in a crowded population like in a prison? I was kind of wondering that. Are there direct links between valley fever and the environment?
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's related. I don't, to my knowledge, it's not related to, you know, the crowd number of people in any given place. It's definitely environmentally related. It's caused by a fungus in the soil, and particularly when there's construction, which there often is around prisons, the dust gets kicked up and people inhale the dust and can get sick if they inhale the fungus. And that was the case for Todd Love, who has been at Avenel for 2 or 3 years now. And he got sick along with at least 30 other people by his count last year. And like Kenneth Hartman, you know, just really described the steep toll that valley fever can take on people. And actually, you know, our research indicated that valley fever might become a bigger problem in the future due to a combination of climate change and increasing droughts and intensive agriculture in places like the California Central Valley or Arizona.
Well, we will link to it on seachangeradio.com. The article is America's Toxic Prisons in the summer 2017 issue of Earth Island Journal. Zoe Loftus-Farron, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Lettuce and Albert King.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.